All right, this is Karen Brewster, and today is May 13th, 2019, and I'm here with Debbie Sanders at her home in Star Valley, Arizona, right near Payson. Beautiful spot. Thank you for letting me stop by today.
Oh, you're welcome.
So you know that you were the curator at Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. And I should say this recording is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So before we get into talking about what you did there, can we get you there? So where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Colorado, born in Denver, raised in Steamboat Springs. And I went to college at Fort Collins, Colorado State University, and was thinking about a career in Park Service.
What did you study in college?
I studied environmental interpretation in the College of Forestry and Natural Resources. And then started out working seasonally. I was at Mesa Verde for a couple of seasons. Went to Carlsbad Caverns for a season. Went to Bandelier for a season. Zion for a season, two seasons, Bryce, Hubble Trading Post for a season, which is where I got on as a museum technician permanent.
What's Hubble Trading Post?
Oh, on the Navajo Reservation up near Ganado, Arizona. It's still a functioning trading post.
Oh, really?
It's very, very cool.
Huh.
Yeah, very cool. That I really had a good time there. I learned to weave and speak a little Navajo.
And what time period are we talking about?
That was in the early 80s. 83, 84 was about when I got on.
At
Hubble Trading Post,
okay.
Yeah. I started working seasonally in 76.
Okay. And when did you graduate from college?
76.
76, okay. So how did you get from environmental interpretation to museum curating?
Yeah, I don't have any college degree in museum studies at all. But when I was at Hubble Trading Post, I was working a lot with the rugs and stuff like that. And it just so happened they had a position come open, and I was able to get on the cert. At that stage, they were doing the OPM certs, and got hired. And so then here I am working with collections, and I realized I really liked it, but I still wasn't sure. So when I left Hubble, I was there for about 4 years. I took a job at Mount Rainier as an interpreter, but I was also responsible for the collections in the libraries.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was doing both. It kind of gave me a chance to do a little bit of both. And then from there, I went to Chiricahua National Monument down in southeast Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Faraway Ranch was brand newly opened, and I was the first ranger in charge of Faraway. And so there again, I was in charge of tours and collections. So I was still doing both.
So is Faraway Ranch a historic building?
Yeah. 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 It's kind of on the edge of the monument, and it used to operate as a guest ranch.
Okay.
Back late 1800s, early 1900s. So, and it's a beautiful stucco building and with some property and stuff.
And so it had collections.
Yeah, big collections.
In the building.
Yeah. Yeah, it had quite a bit that we acquired when the Park Service acquired the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the collections just came right with it. So we were able to, you know, furnish it with its original materials. Yeah. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, you moved around a lot.
And then from there to Skagway.
And that was in 1991?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I guess that's sort of typical Park Service that you, every couple of years, you're moving someplace else.
Yeah. Well, actually, I forgot one. I went to Grand Portage in Minnesota for just a year and a half as a chief ranger. And from there, I went to Skagway.
Okay. And so in all that time, you know, you said you were working with collections and libraries and things. Did you get any training officially along the way?
Just Park Service training.
Yeah.
You know, I would go to curatorial skills and, you know, various Park Service classes that were offered at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, you know, everything. So, but never did I thought about going back to school, but by then I didn't really need to. I didn't feel like I really needed to. I kind of had acquired the skills I needed, you know, on the job and with Park Service training.
So you felt like those Park Service training courses provided you enough background
and experience. And I did go to a couple of private, Campbell Institute, which is in Illinois, mm-hmm. Central Illinois. It's private, but they offer a whole bunch of different museum classes. So I was able to go to a couple of those also, you know, like a month's worth.
And did the Park Service pay for that training?
Yeah, they paid for that.
Now, some of the other, the Park Service trainings, were those in Harper's Ferry? Or
Okay. And then I was also able to attend Ranger Skills at Grand Canyon. And that included everything. That was law enforcement, firefighting, curatorial interpretation. You know, it was kind of all-encompassing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, when you're in that museum collection, you need firearms experience.
You do.
You got to keep those...
You do.
Those dirty fingers off of there. So why did you decide to go to Skagway in 1991?
Well, when I was at Grand Portage, I really did not like the upper Midwest. I needed to go to Alaska to get warm.
First I've heard that.
Oh, man. Lake Superior is just frigid.
Yeah,
I mean, anyway. And I don't know, by then I just decided I wanted to stick with curation. I was really enjoying that, and I thought, Alaska, why not? You know, that'd be fun. So, yeah, and people would always say, people that are not Park Service would say, you know, I moved there in October. You know, what are you doing moving there in October, and do you know anybody? And I'd say, well, what does it matter? It's the Park Service. You know, everybody knows everybody, or you know somebody that knows somebody else, you know, so it never seemed like a big deal to move.
So it was just, it was a job advertised in the federal system?
Yeah, and it actually was a GS-9 museum specialist position. And then after I was there for a year or two, I got upgraded to a 11 museum curator. And actually, I was the very first museum person in the field in Alaska.
What do you mean?
There were no other parks had a curator in the park.
Oh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, because there was a regional
curator. There was a regional curator.
Gene Swearingen-Rodek was the regional curator.
Yep. And at about the same time I was hired at Skagway, they were thinking Sitka also really needed a curator. They were going to have me do both.
Oh, yeah.
And then they realized that wasn't going to work. So then pretty much at the same time, they hired Sue Thorson as a museum specialist at Sitka. So we were the very first two actual curator people or museum people in the parks. Right. And then after that, they started adding a few.
Didn't Denali get one pretty
shortly
soon?
After that, a few years after that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Glacier Bay has one now. I mean, you know, that kind of grew. I think there's most of the parks do have somebody now.
Yeah. Did you ever get an idea of why they decided to create that position in the park instead of sticking with regional?
I think because probably that collection was growing so fast. Mm-hmm. With the archaeology primarily, all the archaeology that was going on, it was a huge collection. And I think they just realized they needed somebody right there, you know, to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And but before you got there then, do you know, how was the collection being handled?
It was being sent out in bits and pieces. I think some of it actually even went to Harper's Ferry. I could be wrong on that. I think it did.
For conservation, maybe.
Well, for curating, too. Oh, I mean, really? For cataloging. And then the region was taking it in.
Now, was there any Klondike staff like Carl Gertke or Betsy Duncan Clark who had been doing some of that just as part of their duties as assigned?
Carl was probably the one closest to doing a little accessioning and stuff like that. They probably shared it a little bit too at the time. So I think Carl was the one that was kind of trying to keep up with it somewhat. But yeah, most of the collections were getting sent out to get cataloged.
Right. Well, what was Betsy's role? Was she at the park when you were there?
Yes.
What was her role?
She was chief of interpretation.
Okay. Because I was thinking that, yeah, as chief of interpretation, you might have some role with the collections because they get used for interpretive things. But,
for sure.
But you're not aware of that.
No, and I know they were wanting to use stuff. I know when I got there, I created a interp collection. mm-hmm. of stuff that we really didn't have a provenience on or anything, so that they were able to use that for their talks and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, but they hadn't anything like that. They weren't doing much. I mean, when I got there, the mascot exhibits were brand new. The old depot exhibits were brand new. I know they've redone all those now again.
Oh, they have?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I heard okay. from Deb.
Yeah, Deb Betcher, she would know.
Yeah, and then I was there in the midst of the Morehouse restoration.
Okay.
And that was my baby.
Okay. Well, before we get to that, tell me, so how did you approach this big collection that obviously hadn't been catalog managed very well?
Well, I think I was very fortunate in having good regional office support. You know, mm-hmm. Jean was great. She was always there. And we just took it a step at a time, you know, and I was able to hire a couple of seasonals.
Mm-hmm.
And they cataloged like crazy. And Deb Betcher, after about, what, she came on, I might have been there 3 years or something when I hired Deb on.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, she catalogs like crazy. So,
that's
yeah,
what
we
I've
just,
heard.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just a matter of a little at a time and getting able to hire the seasonals. And we just kept, and then the archaeology slowed down.
Oh, okay.
You know, after that, all the project archaeology slowed down. Then we were able to start doing like Chilkoot Trail stuff and, you know, and then of course then they acquired more buildings, but they're, you know, the core buildings, once that archaeology was done,
okay.
then it slowed down.
So you didn't have constant incoming collections. You could kind of work on the backlog.
Yeah, and then start working on archives and then start working with a natural history collection and, you know, just add other things into it.
Mm-hmm. So the object collection, there's archaeology and then there's sort of cultural ethnographic pieces. Do you differentiate that?
And history.
And history?
Yeah.
So ethnographic's different than history?
Yes. Ethnographic okay. would be if it's associated with a certain tribe
okay.
or group.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. And then history would be more, you know, like things from the Gold Rush.
Right.
But like objects that haven't come up out of, dug up
right.
out of the ground in an
right.
archaeology project. Okay.
Right.
And then there was an archives.
Then there's the archives.
So what is in the archives?
That would be all the papers, photographs, all the documents for things. Any reports, yeah, photographs.
Old diaries.
Old diaries. Yep.
Letters.
Well, a diary could be considered a historic object,
too. Oh, it could.
Too.
Oh,
if you're looking at it more for the object and not what's inside of it.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it could be. That's where it gets fuzzy.
So how do you decide that when you're doing the curation?
Well, for example, with the Morehouse, we had some diaries, but they didn't, you know, those were more objects. They didn't really document that much of the Morehouse history.
Hmm.
So it was more, we had it out on exhibit.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was more of an object.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then letters.
Letters.
And so is that archive, does that also include the record of the park and documents produced by the park
yes.
and communications and internal memos
yes.
and all that stuff?
Yes. Yeah. So once somebody retires, for example, mm-hmm. when I retired, Deb ended up with all my papers. You know, everything
okay.
that still was in my file drawers. And, you know, I was there long enough that I would turn things over.
Right.
So I didn't just have file drawers full of stuff like
right.
some of the staff did.
Right.
But, yeah, like when chief of maintenance retires, you go in and you clean out their office and you take what, you know, what is
right.
needed for the archives.
So it creates the archive of the park's sort of administrative processes and
exactly
things. Okay. And then...
And they're really going to have fun with Carl.
Yes, they will. Is Deb prepared?
She doesn't think she'll still be there.
because, yeah, my cataloging papers, accessioning and cataloging papers and letters and those, you know, staff records, is that different than cataloging, you know, archaeological objects or historical objects?
It's very different. Yeah, it's very different. The cataloging system that we use has modules that includes everything. But with archives, there's record groups. You know, you kind of have to create a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way you can find them again. Things have to be retrieved.
Yeah.
So you're dealing a lot more with, it's actually more detailed. It takes a lot longer to catalog archives because you have to organize them like by date or, you know, all that kind of thing.
And you don't necessarily catalog every single piece of paper.
No. Not unless, again, it's like more of a historic item, mm-hmm. like maybe historic letters even.
Right.
That what the content of them is really important. You might give each one a separate number.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, it's a group.
Right.
But then you have to have a count.
Oh, of how many pages in that group?
Yeah.
So if it's somebody's work files of correspondence, would you break that up into correspondence about subject A versus subject B, or it's just one big correspondence?
No, it would be separated out if you could.
Uh-huh.
Say, like, for example, archaeology archives.
Right.
You might divide it out by the project.
Okay.
You know, like this was the depot.
Right.
And this was the mascot. And so you'd have it divided out by the projects that way.
But then within that project, would you then divide it by either date? Like this was the year of the project.
Mm-hmm. Then you'd divide it by date.
Or this was, you know, because some of those projects went on multiple years.
Yeah.
And then within the year, would you say, okay, this is correspondence, this is report,
reports,
this is analysis.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And if it's a report, you don't have to count the pages.
Right.
It's one report.
Right. But if it's all their field notes before the report, that's separate than the report.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and those might be in those little field notebook things,
right.
you know, so that would be one count, too. But a lot of times, like their maps
mm-hmm.
would be individual pages. So those are counted individually.
Yeah. And another thing, the field notebooks, again, like, is it by the the mascot project, 1990 field notes, or is it and then 1992 would be field notes,
uh-huh.
or is it mascot project field notes, all the years are together?
We would usually do by year.
Okay.
It just seemed like it made it easier because, for example, when Carl's looking for something, he's asking for year.
Right.
So you kind of, sometimes you start out archiving a certain way, and then you realize, oh, you know what, that's not how people are asking for it. That's not how they're searching for it. So then you might change your process. And, you know, organized by date instead, you know, or have that a more critical thing within the project.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Deb's gotten so good at that.
Right. But so the idea is sort of to think about how people might in the future search and want to find things.
Yeah. Archives are no good if you can't retrieve it.
Right.
You know, it's just no good.
Right.
So you do have to be able to find things again.
Yeah. And but you don't always know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how do you know?
Yeah.
How people are going to want to use it in the future.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, and you do. And so it's kind of a learning game as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And some things you never find again.
Well, and what about photographs? I mean, it's a fairly large collection of photographs, right?
Yes.
So how is that handled?
Yeah, that's a hard one. Again, if they're photographs with, let's say, documenting archaeology,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you've got them right in there with the year, the project, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Carl's the king of that kind of thing. You know, he was always taking our photographs, like our historic photographs,
mm-hmm.
and digitizing them.
Right.
And then he had a system kind of to help for a finder's aid so that people could, you know, look them up.
Uh-huh.
But again, then you would have to do a category, like a building or a person,
right.
or... we would get photo collections in.
Right.
And then it would be, what was that one guy's name? Anyway, there were glass lanterns. Oh, Harper? Hooper. Hooper. It was a glass lantern slide collection that we got in. So that was the Hooper collection.
Mm-hmm.
But then what we ended up doing with those so that they could be usable, this was years ago,
right?
Is we turned them into slides.
Right.
Because this was before...
Right, before digitizing, and glass slides aren't practical.
Right.
But then you number each image.
Yes.
Whether it's a slide or a print or whatever. And then you have some way of describing what it's a picture of?
Yes. Yeah. And we had kind of a standard way of doing it. Would start out by the format, well, like a glass lantern slide.
Right.
Or if it's a print, black and white or color and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would try to describe, you know, its importance. Why is it in the collection? And then if there is anything, you know, like so-and-so is wearing a derby hat or,
right.
I mean, you know, or there's a dog in the picture or, you know, we just kind of add in some description. That way, too, like if people are searching for a certain photo and they're not quite sure what it is, if mm-hmm. we have a good enough description, so we're not having to pull out photos all the time for people to look at, you know, if it's a good enough description, they can say, oh, yeah, that I need to see that photo.
Right.
You know?
And how do you come up with those content themes or wording?
Yeah, there again,
vocabulary—that's
yeah.
the word I'm thinking of.
It's there again. It's kind of a trial and error. You know, you kind of learn what people are wanting and are searching for, and also, you know, some of those Park Service classes I took, they would kind of help you set up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is going to be important,
right?
You know, and kind of tell you this needs to be in the description. The size is going to be down in another field,
right?
You know, so you don't need to put that in there,
right?
You know, kind of a deal.
And date, if you know it. And as you say, a person's name, if you know it. And yeah, I mean, some collections probably come with lots of identification information, and some don't.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I was thinking about standard vocabulary, too, that would be different from one park to the other,
mm-hmm.
probably to some
mm-hmm.
extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does the Library of Congress standard cataloging vocabulary, is that useful?
No, we haven't. I've never really used that. As a librarian in Mount Rainier, I did.
Yeah.
But for cataloging, I never
For cataloging
never
photos
it.
And things, you just came up with your own list.
Yeah. I think some parks do. I think mm-hmm. they do, you know, pull that in, but mm-hmm. I never did.
Okay. And then, of course, once you get into digital records, did you deal with digital records?
Towards the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, towards the end. And I was starting to take pictures of artifacts and include them in our cataloging
mm-hmm.
database, too. That was something fairly new.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, we were actually the Rapuzzi collection. We were digitizing all those photos that
uh-huh.
came from that collection.
Okay. And then how do you keep track of all those photos and what... you catalog them the same way?
Yes.
In terms of the descriptions and the fields and
yes.
everything?
Yes, yeah. And then on the catalog record, you could have the digital number, you know,
uh-huh.
associate that with it. And that works out really good because then people can just scan through,
mm-hmm.
you know, images and not, you don't have to pull out the original image,
right.
you know,
right.
which you try not to do.
And what kind of file naming of the electronic file did you use? Did you come up with a standard... system?
Yeah, there again, and we had some help. There was a gentleman by the name of David Curl, who you maybe have heard his name. He was a seasonal, but he was a photographer, and he did a lot of documentation of the buildings for us. But he was coming in with the Rapuzzi collection, and he was doing the digitizing, and he had ideas because he was already familiar with the park.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we were kind of using the same sort of categories, you know, because... the buildings
right.
and people, certain
right.
people. So we just kind of kept using that same thing because that
mm-hmm.
is what people were interested in.
And so is the electronic file name, you know, is that the accession number? Is that...
No, that'll just be another number.
It's just a random number?
Yeah. Yeah, because like the accession number is really broad.
Oh, okay. Each photo doesn't get its own
a catalog
number. Oh, a catalog number. Oh, okay.
Like the Rapuzzi collection?
Uh-huh.
It's one accession number.
Right. But then each object gets a catalog
number. Catalog
okay.
number.
And that's my misuse of the terminology.
Yes, but I understand that because with a lot of archives,
yeah.
then those are called accession numbers. For
right.
It's used differently.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so when you have a digital photograph, does it get... The file name of that digital photograph, how do you come up with that name? Is there a system you use?
Be
Because each of the hard copy photos has its own number on it, right? Correct. And so the digital ones have a...
Yeah. You know what we would do is somehow on the digital image, we would incorporate the catalog number into it to connect them together.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we would do. And then on the catalog record, because then the digital image also had its own somehow other little, letters afterwards whatever. And we would always put that in. There's a category on the record that for other numbers.
Okay, in the database.
Yeah.
So
that's where that would go.
Okay.
But the catalog number would always be tied in to the digital image.
Right, okay.
Because the catalog number is what's important.
Right. So, yes, you're doing what I was thinking. It was just the terminology. And so all of this is being cataloged in an electronic database system.
Yes.
And is that, what system do you use?
You know, I think they're calling it something different now. We were calling it was Rediscovery.
Okay.
And I heard Deb call it something a little bit different the other day. So I think they've probably upgraded it and they've probably renamed it since I was there. But it's kind of the same.
And was that a Park Service computer program?
Yeah, Park Service wide.
Okay. So in theory, all the parks use the same system.
And you go to training to learn it.
Okay. Other collections. We were talking about archaeology, ethnohistory, history, archives. What else? Oral history.
Natural history.
Natural history.
Okay. Oral history would fall into your archives usually.
Because I know you guys do have. I know Klondike has oral histories as well. It's a natural history.
Natural history. That started when I was there, too. We did not have a natural resource person at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was attending the natural resource conferences for the region. Yeah. And I kind of was pushing the fact that we really needed somebody on staff, whether it be a seasonal or whatever.
Right.
And so they did finally, they hired a seasonal to start with because we were already, we had plant collections. I think we had some fish. I think we had a few, birds. We had a few odds and ends that people just would collect.
Right.
And so then, now it's like a full-blown program.
Yeah.
And, they've had permanent people on staff for probably 25 years for that now.
So that first one, was that Elaine Furbish? Somebody before her?
I'm trying to think if she was actually the first permanent full-time. She was close to it, for sure.
I can't remember if she was seasonal first and then.
No, I think she was hired permanent full-time, but I'm trying to remember if there was anybody before her.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
She did a lot of the plant collecting and the lichen work.
Yeah. And then Meg came in. Meg, what was her last name?
Not Jensen?
Yes.
Okay.
And then Dave Chiricower.
Uh-huh.
And he was still there when I left. He was headed to Denali.
Yeah. So... Managing a natural history collection is, again, a whole nother field, right?
It's a whole nother field. And there I was fortunate that I had a natural history background. That's kind of what I had been, to be an interpreter, that's kind of what I'd been studying. So I already knew plant classification and I already knew that stuff. So that was just an easy kind of thing to blend in.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a lot.
Yeah. And what about storage for all these collections? Is it all stored in the same place?
Two different rooms, separate. Archaeology even is separate. It's in the mascot. Upstairs mascot.
Okay.
Most of the archaeology is there. I think all of it is there. It used to be. History, a lot of the history and archives is in the Pantheon.
Right.
But then there's a separate room that in the Pantheon that holds the natural history collection.
Huh.
So it's off. It's got to be by itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, the what we call the SSB, which is Rapuzzi Collection.
And SSB
stands for Stuff Storage Building. We made that up. It's stuff.
Well, that's true.
And the name stuck, SSB, that's what it's still called.
That's good. And so those storage areas, are they climate controlled at
yes.
all? They are?
Yes. The one that has the worst trouble is the natural history. I think they've done some work on that, though. I think it's better. And it just had kind of it had a heater, but it didn't have any air conditioning in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it would get stuffy up there in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think they've added something to that now.
And so was there any impact on the collections?
No, we were pretty lucky as far as I knew. We never saw mold or we never had insects, which is pretty amazing
yeah.
in a natural history collection. I never noticed any insects. Not much, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just an occasional something.
Right.
But no infestations or anything.
And no roof leaking in any of those old buildings?
Because they'd been restored. They'd all been restored.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nope, no roof leaking.
Cool. Okay, so now tell me about the infamous Rapuzzi collection.
Oh, gosh.
your side of the story.
Yeah, because when I was hired, I was informed that we were getting this collection. This was in 1991. I was told
okay.
we're acquiring this new huge collection. And they even leased or bought a big suburban van for me because they knew I was going to need to be moving this collection around. Well, didn't happen. So I actually let the natural resource crew and the archaeologists have the Suburban because I didn't need it, you know.
Nice, yeah.
So anyway, that they ended up with that. So then, you know, it just kind of fell through there to start with. And then it was revived. The whole idea of acquiring this collection was revived. I don't remember exactly what year it was. But anyway, I was there for the entire going through it.
Yeah.
I was there when we acquired it, and you know, it was Judy Munns, the
mm-hmm.
city's curator, and I that
mm-hmm.
went through the entire collection, and we had, you know, Deb and one of Judy's techs that were over, you know, helping us a lot and doing the inventory and who claims what and putting tags on it and entering the data in the database, and it was fun. It was really fun. It was, we just never knew what we were going to come up on, you know?
Right.
And it got less fun as we got into some of the back storage buildings, which were just full of moldy equipment and, you know, stuff like that. It was less fun, but we still found some pretty amazing, you know, stuff in there.
Do you have some examples of some of those great finds?
I'm trying to think of some of my favorite. Oh, I loved everything that came out of Soapy Smith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the different baskets and the mannequins. You know, the
mm-hmm.
the old Martinichen mannequins
mm-hmm.
and some of the weapons that were found, you know, there's one old rusty pistol that was a very rare find, which ended up, you should probably cross that off your list because that became controversy. Anyway. some really neat, you know, just individual Rapuzzi stuff that they had collected, like books
mm-hmm.
and oh my gosh, there was just so much photos. You know, the photos out of that collection are phenomenal.
So I didn't realize he had photos as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in decent shape.
Yeah, decent, really good shape.
Huh.
Yeah, that is when we started digitizing, is that collection of photos.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some images we'd never seen before that came out of that collection. That could be the most valuable thing out of that whole collection, is those photos.
Yeah.
But I would love to be able to, I didn't see Soapy's finished.
Yeah.
I was involved in furnishings. I was involved in the wallpapering and picking what was going to go where, you know,
mm-hmm.
figuring all that out, actually figuring out which artifact was going to go there. So I was there for that. And then I retired.
Right.
So I'd love to see. I mean, I've seen photos. People have sent me photos and stuff. But I think that was a really fun project. It was a really good one.
Yeah. So the Rapuzzi photo collection, what's the time period?
You know, there's Gold Rush era photos all the way up till the 80s, because the Rapuzzis were still in town in the 80s.
Right.
So it really, and the whole Martin Itchen story with the Soapy Smith Museum, it included all of that. So there were all these pictures of the Soapy Smith Museum.
Yeah.
You know.
Cool.
Every corner of it, practically. Wow. So you could see, you know, what was where, and, you know, that was invaluable.
Right. Those photos were used to help recreate the concept of what's the museum now, the Soapy Smith Parlor.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I never quite have figured out now what's Ron's last name?
Klein.
Thank you. Yeah, he was friends with Phyllis Brown, she was the last Rapuzzi, you know, really, that owned that collection. And somehow or another, he got to be friends with her, and he knew that collection inside out. So he would come up and spend time, you know, and go through. I wouldn't have been able to know what half of that stuff was if it hadn't been for Ron.
You see, it was the photographer from Juneau?
Yes.
Who does those
panoramic
ones?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes. Oh, you know, probably one of the coolest things out of that collection is the Martin Itchen streetcar.
Oh, that was that collection?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That is just one of the coolest things.
And what kind of shape was it in?
Good.
Really?
They used to, up until, I think, right before I got there, they used to crank that thing up and run it in the 4th of July parade.
Wow. And I guess you guys decided that was no longer a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was stuck away in this other building. Nobody knew where it was because they didn't want it sabotaged or anything. You know, they were really careful to keep that quiet. So now I think it's restored and, you know, they've done a lot with it. So, but that was really a cool thing.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my understanding that the Rapuzzi collection was in multiple buildings in Skagway.
Yes.
So, yeah, how do you even know where to start?
We didn't. Well, and that was one thing, is that some of the buildings that were in really poor shape, Ron had removed the stuff, and Phyllis owned another building called the Alascom. It was the old Alascom building, and she had a house on one end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other end was just open. And so Ron brought in shelves, and he just hauled a lot of the stuff and put it on those shelves. And so he saved a lot of the stuff, you know. A lot of the buildings that were still in really poor condition, like Fifth Avenue Warehouse and Commissary, it was mostly great big equipment and you know, stuff like that was still in it.
Mm-hmm.
When we got there, the Rapuzzi house was still absolutely full of stuff, and they had an attic and a basement.
Yeah.
But that stuff was in pretty good condition because the house was still in pretty good condition. But I think, you know, Ron saving all that stuff out of the Soapy Smith Museum.
Right.
And those other two buildings that were in pretty poor condition, you know, that's what kind of saved it.
Right.
And then we had everything. So that's the stuff we started with first.
Was the stuff Ron had saved?
Yep. Yeah. Because we figured he was going to pull the good stuff.
Right.
And we would need to deal with that stuff first.
And did he pull the good stuff?
Yeah, he did. He did. There was, you know, he didn't worry about the house.
Right.
Because it was in good shape.
Right.
But most of that stuff, I mean, there was some older things in the house, but most of that was 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, later stuff.
Well, I was thinking in some of those older buildings that were maybe structurally not as sound, was that an issue for you guys going in? Were there safety concerns?
Yeah, and, you know, especially, asbestos.
And mold.
Yeah, it was. It was. Like, there were a couple times when we were working in the Fifth Avenue warehouse that we came up on something that had asbestos, and we had to close down, you know, and wait and get it mitigated, and then we go back in again. So, yeah, and we were kind of a pilot project, you know, working with something like this collection where we didn't know what we were going to be coming up on.
Right.
We did the best for establishing our safety protocol. You know, I had written up safety things, but mm-hmm. some of those staff were still not good with it. I couldn't do any more.
Right.
We would wear masks. We would wear gloves. We would, you know, do the best we could, but we could open up a box of something in the collection and we didn't know what was in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had to be kind of willing, you had to be kind of easygoing about that kind of stuff. And it was kind of hard for some people to deal with that.
I would say, did you ever open a box and find critters in there?
Oh, yeah. You know, dead stuff, usually.
Usually dead
stuff. Yeah.
So you didn't open and find a live mouse settled
in there? No. I can't remember that happening. I mean, it would have the mice running around and stuff, but... No, I don't recall
that. And in Skagway, thank goodness you don't have snakes that might come out of the box.
No. Oh, I'll have to tell you my snake story from this morning later.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. It's interesting.
But I think there are some employees who might be excessively sensitive to mold or dust or things like that. So
we actually had respirators, mm-hmm. you know, if it... we kind of left it up to individuals, depending on where we were working.
Right.
A lot of times we'd at least require a dust mask.
Right.
But we had available, you know, full gear respirators.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anyone wanted to wear them, they sure were more than welcome to. We never, you know.
Were there staff that said, I can't work on this, I have to do something else?
Well... Okay, but the people we hired specifically for that project, they had to be aware. But I did lose one of them, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because just the health reasons.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, it's certainly not for everybody.
Yeah, and she wanted me to have a crystal ball and be able to know what, you know, everything we were going to encounter. Right.
And there weren't some other duties you could give her, like, back in the office so she wouldn't have to...
She was hired specifically for Rapuzzi collection.
Well, I didn't know if you could sit at the computer and do the database part while somebody else is doing
it. Yeah, well, we did that as much as possible.
Right.
But
they the people you hired had to be able to do everything.
Yeah. Yeah, we really did because, you know, certain days we would need, you know, everybody in working, you know. If we'd be working hard to try to move things around or whatever, we would just need, you know, all hands on deck, so to speak.
How many people did you have ever at one time working on that project?
Let's see, counting Judy and I, 5 or 6. 6, I think, at the most.
Okay. As we said, we know it was you, Judy, and Deb Betcher.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else you care to mention?
Two of Judy's, well, let's see, Deb Hewlett from the museum.
From the city museum?
Yeah, she was pretty involved with it.
Okay.
I'm not sure she's still there.
I was wondering how you and Judy Munns went through and made the decision about who gets what.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. you know, for the most part, we had no problem with that. The way we sort of had it set up is that pretty much anything that was Gold Rush went to the park.
Okay.
Although you start ending up with stuff that's duplicates,
mm-hmm.
then it's easy, you know.
Right.
Things that are more Skagway history related went to the City Museum. But then where we ended up having to do some wheeling and dealing was some of the stuff that we ended up needing for Soapy Smith's museum that had been claimed by the city. But because we did that before we figured out furnishings for Soapy's.
Oh,
we
okay.
claimed stuff before. But Judy was always really good about, you know, and if there was something we both really, really wanted, we'd wheel and deal a little.
you know, arm wrestle for it.
Yeah. Okay, you can have that if I can have this. We'd do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we worked together actually very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
It was very fortunate. We could have been duking it out.
Well, did you both have collection, what are they called, management plans or like a mission statement?
Yes, yes.
What's that called for a
collection management plan?
Yeah, that said this is the type of material we have.
Yes.
And that, so you could use that to guide you.
Scope of collections. That's scope of collections. Scope statement. Of
collections. Thank you.
Yeah, I had to see. I'm rusty on these.
Me too. I couldn't think of the word.
Yeah, scope of collections.
Yeah.
Yes, we both did.
And was that helpful?
Yes, except that Judy's spilled over to the gold rush.
Hmm.
You know, because that is part of Skagway history.
Right.
So that's where she was also wanting gold rush stuff. So, I mean, you know, sure, some of it, you know, it worked out. And then because the Park Service couldn't have any sales, right. You know, the stuff that neither of us wanted.
Yeah.
Well, we would designate that with, see, we would do, we had colored little dots. And we had a code, like blue dot was city owned, red dot was park owned, and yellow dots nobody really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a numbering system, like I think A, let's see, how do we do that? K was for the park or something, and I don't know, I can't remember. But it seemed like A was for the yellow stuff that nobody really wanted. But the city still had to claim responsibility for that because they could sell. They could have auctions.
Right.
They could offer it to other museums or whatever where the park couldn't.
I know the park couldn't sell it, but the park couldn't acquire it and then offer it to another museum.
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay.
Yeah, we could do that. But the way that's harder. That's kind of hard.
Yeah. And the way, my understanding, clarify that the way the collection was acquired, it was actually sort of all bought and given to the city. So that they could sell what was to be disposed of?
I believe that is true. I believe that is true, but then the Park Service paid actually for it too. But to start with, I think that is exactly true.
And because
that's the way they were able to do it.
Because there was so much that was going to have to be disposed of,
yeah.
And the park would have a problem.
That's right.
Doing that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and I think Judy has had some sales now, but it took her forever to be able to get that together.
Yeah. Well, it's an issue in museum collections everywhere, in archives too, is what do you do with the stuff that you can't use or doesn't fit with your scope of collections?
That's hard.
So were there other things in the Park Service collections that you had to deal with that?
No, I think, you know, the Rapuzzi collection, because we were, I'm trying to think of some of the other collections we may have gotten in as a whole. It wouldn't be that much that didn't really fit, so we would just keep it.
Okay.
For the most part. Just not make an issue of it.
Yeah, so the Park Service has different policies than like public museums or private museums.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. We're very, very strict as far as when when you acquire something, you know, and you can't sell or, you know, you can't dispose of very easily.
You can't just throw it in the trash.
You can deaccession. If things are just so deteriorated and that doesn't fit your scope or whatever, you can, you know, you have to deaccession, though. It has to still be documented, and then you can deaccession.
And then dispose of.
Mm-hmm. Dispose of. Yeah, one of my first projects was of a disposal. The Mascot Saloon, all the Rainier beer bottles that are in there. Harper's Ferry is the one that did that project. And so they contracted out those beer bottles to the lowest bidder, which happened to be Jamestown Glassworks, which hand blows their bottles. Well, Rainier beer bottles were never hand blown.
Right.
So we ended up with this collection of bottles. They were all different. It's kind of neat, right?
Right.
But they weren't historically correct. So we were able to find actually a beer bottle collector in Washington who would find them for us.
Oh.
And I can't remember that guy's name, but we would acquire a few at a time from him. He would buy them from him till we needed 200 because they're all over in the window and everything like that. And then we deaccessioned all those beautiful bottles, but one of the maintenance guys and I took them out to a trash bin and smashed them because we had to.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're going to end up.
But why did Harper's Ferry get those created to not match?
Who knows? That was just, you know, they make mistakes like that.
Yeah.
You know, they just do. They should have just said, no, we can't do it that way. But I think it was kind of their quickest, easiest way to do it. And that's what they did.
Well, I didn't realize. I thought all those bottles in the mascot came from the excavations.
No.
They're not reproductions.
They're original historic bottles.
But not necessarily from Skagway.
Correct. Yeah.
Sneaky.
We're good at those things.
Yeah. Back to the Rapuzzi and that weeding all that out. So the Park Service did not get extra things. You just got what you identified.
Correct.
All the extra stuff Judy and the city has to deal with.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we only claimed and then cataloged the stuff that fit our scope of collections that we wanted.
And which was how many thousands of objects, remember?
No. You know, that they said that whole collection originally was supposedly millions. I can't even remember what they said. Mm-hmm. And by the time we weeded it all out, really, and we didn't catalog every single piece of paper, you know. It turned out to be more like, I think it was around 33,000 or something like that. Don't quote me exactly on that number, but it was a lot less than what they anticipated. And I just don't recall how many thousand Deb would be able to tell you that.
The general number of, you know,
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot, but not as many as Judy ended up having to deal with.
Well, and I was, you know, wondering, I've heard about the Rapuzzi collection, and he had so many multiples of things, you know, like old vacuum cleaners or machine parts and things. You couldn't just leave those in the buildings and shut the door and walk away and not even take them?
Well, except, you know, they had plans for each of the buildings eventually.
So
otherwise, and we did end up, like, the Fifth Avenue. We cleaned out quite a bit of it because they were needing to do a lot of restoration work. That thing was falling apart. Uh-huh. And everyone had claimed what they wanted it to be. But Deb said they still haven't decided. They're still going round and about what to do with that building.
Is that the, what they call the YMCA?
Yes. Myers Market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the building that they've been in active restoration, at least on the building. The interior, is probably still being debated.
So that's why we had to kind of empty it out. And another one that's had so much stuff in it was the commissary building next to Soapy's, which belongs to the city. They own that building.
And that was a World War II building?
Yes. Yeah. It's a pretty neat building, really.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, we didn't have it cleaned out when I left. Things were already, you know, inventoried and stuff. Mm-hmm. But Judy was still acquiring storage buildings and trying to figure out where she was going to put everything too.
I mean, it's not all in her museum collection area in the McCabe building. That's where they are, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, she had to acquire all sorts of storage sheds, and not sheds, but what do you call those
units? Like ADCO units?
Yeah. Yeah, she was just, I felt bad for her.
Yeah.
Here we were getting the state-of-the-art building, for the Rapuzzi collection, and she was struggling to find places to put stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting that commissary building, because it's city-owned, the restoration and maybe use for exhibits isn't happening because
it's not a not a priority for the city.
And the Park Service won't do it for non-Park Service buildings. They only do that restoration on buildings they've acquired.
That's correct. Right? Yeah, that's correct. They'll help. You know, they'll advise and stuff like that and help other people that are trying to restore a historic building. Mm-hmm. And they'll help them get grants maybe or, you know, that kind of a deal.
Right.
Yeah.
They won't pay for it.
They won't pay for it.
So in all that negotiation with Judy, as you said, you guys sometimes kind of bartered. Are there things that you wish the Park Service could have gotten that you didn't get?
Just the stuff that ended up needing to go into Soapy's, you know, which I don't know how they ended up doing that, whether they're just on loan from the city, that kind of stuff, or whether Judy ended up, because that was after I left.
Right.
But, you know, if we'd had a chance, but we couldn't. I was going to say if we'd been able to do it vice versa, if we'd been able to figure out a furnishing plan for the Soapy building first, it would have been a lot easier. Then I would have said, well, we need this for Soapy's. But we couldn't do that because we didn't have the photos to study yet, or We couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do those things have to be in Soapies, or could you have used other objects in Soapies?
It would have been noticeable. I mean, some of the, like, the baskets and the bottles, covered bottles, mm-hmm. and the cigar cutter that's on the counter, and, you know, some of those items are so distinct that, you know, we could have maybe had a replica made or something, but, you know, that's such a cool thing about that building, is all the stuff is original in there.
Yeah. And it's because you had the photos to know what had been there originally.
Yeah.
That the idea was to replicate that.
Yeah. Yeah, those photos were wonderful.
Yeah. So, yeah, talking about replicas, what's the sense in exhibit work of using replicas? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, you don't if you can help it. Mm-hmm. But, well, the Morehouse we ended up having to quite a bit. Or similar items, maybe not replicas, but, you know, similar historic items, mm-hmm. like the Rainier bottles.
Right.
I mean, if you need to create the scene, you know, then that's okay. Mm-hmm. But you know, you let people know. Like, I would always have a catalog book for the curator, for the interpreters, mm-hmm. and it would tell what was original and what was a replica or what had been purchased for the exhibit. So if somebody, you know, on a tour asked, they had the information, you know, that they could go to, so that they wouldn't say, oh, yeah, it's all original, you know.
Right.
They would have that information.
I have questions about the Morehouse, but you brought up the exhibit. What's the connection or the role of a curator in exhibit planning and design versus the interpretation exhibits person? Mm-hmm.
You're both involved pretty heavily. But the curator, really the interpreter, it's going to be the content, you know, what's said, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But the curator is involved with any of the props, you know, any of the artifacts or anything like that that's going to be in there. Mm-hmm. So you work together. You know, I actually was involved helping out with several major exhibits while I was there. And yeah, it's fun. And then you usually end up contracting somebody else out to actually come and do the work.
The Harper's fabrication.
Ferry, yeah, Harper's Ferry used to do most of it. Mm-hmm. But they don't anymore. It's just too much. So they still get involved, but there's, you know, Cornerstone out of Portland, Oregon. Or, I mean, there's different companies now.
That do the fabrication part.
Yes, yeah. But so they'll come to the park and work with interpreter and curator and whoever else, you know, and get an idea of what, you know, what exists that can be used for the exhibit already. Mm-hmm. And then just kind of work off of that.
And so what were some of those exhibits you worked on?
Well, I was there to finish up the mascot. Mm-hmm. But the Moore House and the Moore Cabin were the big ones, yeah.
Okay. And so you said the interpretive person, sort of, they write the text, sort of the narrative first? And then they show it to you and you say, oh, I think this object could go there, this could go there.
Well, you know, actually the company that gets hired ends up even doing the writing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they'll work, you know, they'll work with the interpreter to kind of see what the story needs to be.
Okay.
And the interpreter might help do the writing, but pretty much everything I've remembered, the actual writing is also done by the contractor.
Uh-huh. But then again, So you're involved at the beginning with the mm-hmm. discussion about what's the story that needs to be told?
Yes. Yeah. And then also, you know, what do you want to tell? And then what can you use to tell the story? You know, so that they get a whole idea of that kind of an idea. And the park will have a concept of what they want, you know, to go into a building or a room. Mm-hmm. And then the contractor works with the park to help design the cases, if there's cases, or, you know, the text and the little display units and, you know, all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Because they're the experts, you know, on that kind of stuff. Right.
But, so let's say that contract, they come to Skagway, do you take them through the collections and show them things?
Sure. Yeah, you kind of get an idea ahead of time, you know, as to what could be used. Mm-hmm. And then that gives them a concept, you know, of what could be used as a prop, and that might sway their wording a little, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Or, yeah, if you have a great object, you don't have to use the words at all.
Right, right.
Right. So tell me about the Morehouse and Cabin project. Because that sounds like that was your a biggie.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the Rapuzzi collection kind of was the icing on the cake at the end. But the Morehouse was the last of the original buildings mm-hmm. that the park acquired to get funded for restoration. Mm-hmm. And it was decided to turn it in. The cabin had already been restored, but we ended up doing a lot more work to it. The cabin, just quickly on that one, what we ended up doing, because it had original newspaper all over the walls and the ceiling and everything, and that was where the Moors originally, that was their very first building that they mm-hmm. built. And we were losing that newspaper right and left, so we hired a paper conservator to come in, Eileen Clancy. And she used to be out of Oregon? I don't remember. She's moved around. She's done several projects for us. But so she ended up coming in and helping document, photographing every inch of that. And then we had a company replicate the newspaper and put it back up. But we left it, all the holes were, you know, we didn't try to fill in what wasn't there already.
Okay.
And they have them on these panels so that you can actually, in the wintertime, remove them.
Oh.
And store them, you know, somewhere climate controlled.
Okay.
And then that's one of Deb's things she does in the spring is puts those panels back out in the Moore cabin. And so that was a really interesting project.
Yeah.
We were finding Ben Moore's signature on the wall and, you know, stuff like that.
Now, behind the newspaper or on the newspaper?
Or up above on one of the little boards that we hadn't noticed, that nobody had really noticed it before, you know, kind of a deal. So that was kind of fun. And they were keeping a tally of different things. And
did they preserve some of the original newspaper?
We preserved all of it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yep, it all got sent to a conservator.
Okay.
And it's all in folders.
In the collections.
In the collections. Map drawers, you know, all labeled to exactly, you know. Each little section had its own numbers letters.
It was mapped out. It was like a log cabin where you number each log and take it apart and put it back together.
Yeah. It's perfect. You know, that was just a really fun project. So the Moore House, they decided it was when I first moved there, they were using it to store old park furniture that they know, you know, desks and tables and stuff like that. So, you know, we got all that stuff moved out. And then I got involved with the whole thing, the whole restoration project, working, you know, with the conservators that were working on the building, working with our crew doing the restoration, working with Cornerstone to do the exhibits, and Harper's Ferry was involved with that, working with the furnishings plan.
And there was archaeology done, I assume, for that house.
That was just being finished up when I got there, Kathy Spooty.
Okay.
Yeah, I was doing that stuff.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it was like, in this situation, we didn't have a whole lot of the original material from that house. Because then it had been upgraded and someone else had lived in it.
And the Kermseys lived in it?
Yeah, the Kermseys lived in it.
Yeah.
So we were able to, actually the Kermseys, while I was there, had an auction when they were moving, kind of getting out, and Georgette was still there. She came to the dedication. I visited her in her house, Georgette Kermsey. Anyway, they had an auction, and we actually recognized a couple items from the Moore House that we were able to purchase to have put back in. But most of the items in the Moore House are replicas, or, you know, historic pieces, but not original
to the house.
Yeah, and we were getting close to the, I'll always remember this, we were getting close to the dedication. And Jeff Mull, who still does, he does his own construction stuff in town now, but he was involved in a lot of the restoration work in town. He was a good friend of mine. And I was noticing he was getting kind of grumpy. And so one time I said, well, Jeff, you know, what's going on? And he said, the building is not going to be done in time for the dedication. What? So he said, no, this is what we still have to do. So we put the word out, and even Clay Alderson, the superintendent, was over there painting, sanding boards, you know, and we got the whole, everybody on staff that could spend any time. I was over there every day. You know, anybody that could, we were over there putting our everything in to get that done. And by golly, barely, we got that building put together by the time we needed it. But poor Jeff, he was, you know, he just didn't think it was going to happen. Yeah. And it wouldn't have.
Well, it's impressive that a superintendent would go and pick up a paintbrush. And
he was great. Too bad you can't. I don't even know where. Are you going to get him?
No, I did. Okay. So how did you know what the inside of the Moore house might have looked like?
We had some pictures, but the majority of that collection is at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Oh. So I spent a week there. Ben Moore had a photo album. And it had the house room by room. Unfortunately, the page that was labeled Moore House Kitchen, the photo was gone.
Oh, I hated that.
And I think there was one other photo that was labeled that wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But it had, you know, several of the parlor, it had the bedroom, you know, it had everything else. Oh, I know, the living room area was only partly photographed. So that's the area where we ended up, the kitchen, and that is where we ended up putting the cases with the exhibits and the text, you know, to tell the story.
Right.
And then the rest of it that was well documented, we refurnished.
Okay.
Is what we did.
And then did you have in the collections all that period pieces? You say it wasn't necessarily what had been the Moors, but did you have things you could put in, or did you have to go acquire?
Harper's Ferry had to end up acquiring a lot of that stuff. Brown, whatever his first name is. Bill Brown. Mm. He was the one that was involved with that, and he had been at Harper's Ferry forever. He was really experienced at going to auctions and estate sales, you know, antique stores, stuff like that, and he already knew, you know, what was needed. We had items that belonged to the Moores, like diaries and, you know, photo albums and photo frames and ivory pieces and some things like that that ended up in the cases.
Right.
Because it didn't show them in the photos. So that's how we did that.
Right.
But so, yeah, most of the stuff in there other than the original items probably came from West Virginia or, you know, somewhere like that.
Now, how did you know that these pieces you had belonged to the Moores?
How did we get that collection? Georgette? I think.
So when the Kermseys moved into the house, they had them or something.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember exactly how that handful of wonderful more memorabilia. I mean, with Edith Gertrude, there's an autograph album for one of the girls, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's just really cool. Ben Moore did her autograph for her, signed, you know, did something for her. And so his writing is in there. And I am trying to remember for sure where that collection came from. And I can't quite remember.
But you think it was some sort of a local donation?
Yeah, I'm sure it was, but I just don't remember who it was.
So when you say that you worked with the restoration crew and you were there every day, what is the curator doing out there in the field in a building?
Helping them. And I only helped, actually, like in the maintenance building at the end. But I worked with the, I'm trying to think who was doing the restoration plan on that. Who from the regional office?
What was the date? The 90s?
Yeah, it would have been late 90s. It wasn't Grant Crosby yet. It was Steve Peterson. Steve Peterson.
Okay.
Yeah, he and I got to be friends. But, you know, I don't know, there's just something about when you're working with just figuring out the restoration of a building, too, it's an artifact. You know, when you think about it, the building is also an artifact. And so they like having, you know, our input. Not that we're hanging around all the time, but they like our input. Yeah, Steve Peterson was a real fun one to work with, too. And Grant's great.
But so what do you say, your input? What does that mean? I mean, what are you telling them? Like,
Well, you know, okay.
Did you stand there with a photo and say, okay, look?
Well, you know, there again, when you go into the Morehouse, you take out everything. It still has the wallpaper up. It still has, you know, original flooring, ceiling. One of the rooms actually had a painting around the lamp, around the light. So then you start talking about, well, okay, you know, that's important. That has to be redone. That painting needs to be, preserved.
Right. Don't tear out the wallpaper.
Yeah, yeah. Don't tear off the wallpaper. Okay, this is tongue and groove wall in here. There's some original wood board flooring. We need to preserve that.
Okay.
That kind of, just that kind of
stuff. But that helps, that sort of detail, because you go, what are you doing in there? There are no objects in there anymore.
Yeah, Just that kind of, the fabric.
Mm-hmm. And so did the Morehouse project get finished while you were there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that was...
Oh, that's right. You said you had that celebration.
Yeah, yeah. That was... When did we dedicate that one? Late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
Was Clay still the superintendent?
Yes.
So it would have been... He left in 99.
Okay, it was 97 or 8. It
would have been before that.
David Esslinger was the new chief of interpretation. And I was always... angry because he got to cut the ribbon and he'd just gotten there. He had no part in it.
That's right.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. Now, the Peniel Mission, which is behind the Morehouse, was that a project you were involved in? That was before.
You know, the only way I was involved in that is helping to pick out furniture. For the seasonal quarters.
That is not historic.
It was already done. But our chief ranger at the time, Bruce Reed, he was kind of put in charge of picking out the beds and the couches and all that for me, you know, for that building. And so he wanted help. So I helped him with that. Other than that, no, it was done.
So you became the interior designer.
I became the interior designer.
Well, I've stayed there. Thank you. I don't know if it's the same furniture.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. Well, that Morehouse does sound pretty exciting.
It was fun.
Go from beginning to end.
Yeah. That was fun. That's the only time I've ever done that. You know, because Faraway Ranch, when I got there, the restoration was done at Chiricahua.
Mm-hmm.
That was done. It was just putting the furnishings back in.
Right.
So, but to start it from the beginning and see it through to the end was very rewarding. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there things that you wish you could have completed? Well, you said you wanted to see the Soapy thing. But...
Yeah, Soapies. I would have. I just didn't want to stay that long.
Yeah. How about in terms of the collections management and the process?
No, I think I felt pretty good. You know, I really wanted to get the Rapuzzi collection, figured out, to get that done, and to figure out who's getting what and to get it pretty well cataloged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was important to me. I had no worries about leaving it at that stage. Soapy Smiths was the thing. You know, that would have been, because I was very involved in the beginning of that. That would have been fun, but, and, you know, I knew, Deb knew what she was doing for cataloging, and, you know, I knew they'd get another good curator in and stuff, so I really wasn't, you know, that was all fine. I think I left it at a pretty good time overall.
And the Soapy Smiths, so you were involved in some of the exhibit planning, we should put this there and that, but you weren't there to actually physically put it in.
No.
So with the exhibit designing and planning, do you feel like it was going to be a good building?
Yeah, I think it was going to be super. I think just, you know, because it's original materials in there.
Yeah.
You know, you can say pretty much for everything that was originally in here. That, you know, it belonged here. So, you know, and that really adds to it, I think.
And you don't worry about the impacts to those objects being out on display?
Well, you know, I think they're being very, very careful. Yeah, you always do. You know, as a curator, you know, those automatons that are moving around in there and all that kind of stuff, you know. But as a curator, you do. But I think it's more important to have them And I think the way they're doing their tours now, too, they're not just letting people wander through and they're restricting the numbers and all that. I think they're doing the best they can, mm-hmm. you know, for making sure things stay good. And I don't know what they've done for climate control.
I don't know.
I really don't know. But those moose in the back, you know, those were a nightmare. Yeah. But it all came together, and from the pictures I've seen, it's done very, very well.
Now, is the mascot climate controlled for the exhibits?
No. Nope. They put those doors wide open in the summer. At least they used to.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a plan to rotate objects off exhibit?
You know, most of the stuff, you know, they were even talking about redoing that whole exhibit. Hmm. And I know Deb fought against that.
Why?
She likes things the way they are, okay. you know. And sometimes, you know, because the chief of interp at the time, can't think of his name, he came after I was there. But he was into the new stuff, you know, where you can carry around a little box and listen or push a button and listen to stuff. And Deb likes the old fashioned, you know, the mannequins at the bar. And, you know, she just likes that all that kind of stuff. And, you know, part of me does too. Part of me does too. There's something about old museums and old, you know, exhibits that have a charm to them.
So how do you negotiate that difference of perspectives?
I think it depends on your superintendent, which direction they go, you know.
It's so they're the final say?
Yeah.
If there's conflicts like
that? Yeah, usually so. If they can get money for it, you know, then you have to come up with funding if you're going to redo something. Mm-hmm. And I know they have. I was told they redid the exhibits in the depot, in the admin building over there, mm-hmm. which I don't have any qualms about that anyway. Those were just cases and, you know. That didn't matter. But the mascot, one of the mannequins, I know they fashioned after Frank Norris. It looks just like Frank Norris.
That's fun. little secret fun fact. and that's a question I was going to have about funding for collections versus other aspects of park activities and how that went while you were at Klondike.
Yeah, you know, a lot of funding, and I'm sure it's still that same way, it all depends on the curator or other people putting in these project statements mm-hmm. that you compete, you know, PMIS and all right. these other systems that you just have to come up with some really good projects that get regional offices' attention, you know, to get funded. So it really, I think a lot of it is that, you know, just getting out there and putting out those projects. And
do you feel while you were there that you were being supported by the park administration and were getting...
I'd say, yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think so. It seems like it was, you know, I felt like I had good support, mm-hmm. especially with Clay.
Yeah. Did you have to fight for your dollars?
Not too bad. It seemed, because I don't know, I wasn't as greedy as a lot of the others were either. I think the things that I was asking for were really legitimate needs, you know, kind of a deal. Instead of, wouldn't it be nice to have this or whatever.
So there was recognition that the collections mattered.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, in the structure of the park, the curator is under the cultural resources person?
That's how it turned out. When I first came on board, I was under the chief ranger.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have a chief of cultural or natural resources.
Okay.
So, and then it was later on that they added the chief of cultural resources, which was under the superintendent.
Right.
They really changed it around.
Right. And that first person hired as the chief of just resources in general, was that Teresa Tebow?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my memory anyway, is she was the first one.
Right.
And she was there quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And how did that work, that structure? How did that work?
I think it was good. It doesn't really make sense to put it under the chief ranger, you know, as such. And then we had one person, you know, like I told you, when I first got there, there wasn't any natural resources.
Right.
But then they had that hired. So then to have somebody that oversaw both, mm-hmm. you know, made sense. Mm-hmm. And Teresa was... very capable of that. I felt like she did a very good job. Her background is cultural.
Right, she was an archaeologist.
Yeah, so, but she still did well with the natural. I thought she was good that way too.
Mm-hmm. And did she provide any input on collections and use of material or
yes.
preservation things?
She, only if she felt she needed to, kind of, you know, if it was a major project that was affecting the whole park or whatever. But she was pretty good at letting me kind of do my job as such. Yeah. She kept us informed pretty well. You know, there's always issues, but I think overall it works that way.
Mm-hmm. When I was thinking, you know, Klondike is a smaller park. Mm-hmm. There are fewer staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how the staff, you know, got along, interacted, or if there were issues, how issues got resolved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, then it would be meetings, you know, and just get it resolved. But we seem to get along pretty well. Of course, you talk to Elaine, she quit the park because of Teresa.
Yeah.
So there's going to be conflicts. You know, nobody's ever going to, everyone's not going to get along.
Right.
But, and that was too bad.
Yeah.
Because I thought Elaine was doing a really good job.
Yeah. So you felt if you had issues that they got, do you remember if there were any issues and how they might have gotten resolved?
Mm-hmm. There were issues, which there was one major one, which I don't think I better actually bring up, but I was very well supported on it. Let me just put it that way.
Can you talk about it in a general sense? Like, was it a
it had to do
conflict with the individual's behavior? Or?
It had to do with the one seasonal that was hired for the Rapuzzi collection
okay.
that felt like I was not being safe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that got resolved.
Yeah,
yeah,
it got resolved.
I understand the concern about people's
yeah,
privacy,
that was a very know. Bad, that was a bad enough situation that I almost quit. Yeah.
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 Because that employee was, they were complaining about you
yes.
to the higher-ups.
Yeah. Yeah. And she knew what she was getting into, but she still felt like I wasn't, you know, protecting them enough because mm-hmm. I guess she felt like I should already know what was in the collection, you know?
Right.
And that's what we were doing, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, you know, that was another reason I retired when I did, is I ended up with this kind of a bad situation, and that got resolved,
mm-hmm.
you know, to where I didn't deal with that my last 2 years. But it was still a bad situation.
It left a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And that's what I was wondering is how leadership in the administration
yeah.
handled that?
They supported me.
Okay.
They totally supported me. Yeah. But that employee made things so bad.
Yeah, that's too bad.
So that's where the bad taste comes from. It doesn't come from the administration.
Mm-hmm.
It came from that situation okay. with her. She was pretty nasty.
Yeah. Were there other things along the way in the years that were particularly challenging? Just, you know, the job in general, different tasks, different projects, personalities,
oh yeah,
whatever.
Always, seems like some of the bigger issues came with the natural resource collections. The Dave, when he was there, he's very smart.
Sure, Cowan.
And
that Dave, okay.
Yeah, and he got lots done and stuff. But they were doing more lichens collecting still during that time. And he, somehow or another, he ended up with he had a key to that collections room. And he would go in on his own. And, well, a bunch of lichens disappeared. He sent them out and we never got them back, you know, so stuff mm-hmm. like that. So, I don't know, it seems like, and, you know, no matter who you're working with, sometimes getting the archaeologists to deal with their, you know, archaeology collections instead of just like, well, here is everything, you know, turn it over to you. They can't do that. You know, they have to at least do some processing.
Mm-hmm.
So there were always little issues that way. And we'd end up with backlogs, you know, just stuff. Because that's not the fun part for the archaeologists. They'd rather be out digging around, and you know, they don't want to process.
So that means they have boxes of stuff under their desks that they're supposedly analyzing. They don't want to give it to you.
Yeah, or they'll give it to us, but we're not supposed to take it if it's not already, you know, accessioned and stuff.
Oh.
But they'll want us to store it.
Oh, okay.
And then it's out of sight, out of mind for them.
So you're not supposed to take it until they've somehow processed
Correct.
It in... That they organize it in groups or something. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought the museum people did all that.
Yeah, they're supposed, because they're the experts. They're the ones that were out there with it, you know, and they're supposed to do the basic cataloging. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, then it gets turned over. We enter the data. The curators enter the data.
But you, as the curator, don't decide that this is a nail, or this is a porcelain, or this is ceramic, or
that's
they
them.
Do that. Oh,
that's
okay.
They're supposed to. But doesn't always happen. They're supposed to.
So then, how do you organize an archaeological collection that comes to you en masse, not processed?
Yeah, you don't. You can't. I mean, you know, because it needs to have, you know, for archaeology, it has to have provenience.
Right.
Has no value.
You know, which square grid it came out of and all that.
It's no value otherwise. And that's from their field notes. That's, you know, everything. They're the ones that put the codes on the bags, you know, and stuff. So, you know, they hand it over to the curator and you're like, okay, you know, this doesn't mean anything. So they have to, you know, to really be the first ones to have their hands on that collection after they get it out. And they're supposed to do the cleaning and stuff too.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to do that out in the field, in theory. But
and Deb's so good at it because that's what she started out doing, was cataloging for the archaeologist.
Oh.
So, you know, she knows how to do all that.
Right.
Yeah.
But most curatorial people do not.
No. You know, I mean, I've done archaeology too, so I do. But we're not supposed to have to. And without having it put together, you know, with the field notes and all that, it takes forever.
Yeah. And I've been wondering about the use of archaeological material findings analysis in exhibits, and how do you use that material to teach the public something?
Do you mean the actual artifacts?
Yeah. Well, the combination of the artifacts or what are telling them. How do you get the public to understand the importance of these pieces of...
Okay.
Whatever that comes out of the ground.
Yeah, we used to do some temporary exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
We had two or three different exhibit cases that we would rotate every year. You know, every summer or spring would put in a new exhibit. And those exhibit ideas and stuff are all archived. You know?
Okay.
But, you know, like, for example, one that we did was called How Archaeology Artifacts Helped Tell the Story.
Yeah, there you go. That's
so we would do that kind of thing where we'd have, you know, artifacts and then archaeology information and how it pieces together and what it tells, you know, kind of an idea. We would do exhibits on medicine bottles that were archaeology, you know, that were dug that way. And, you know, we would explain where they came from and how they were found. And then we'd maybe get into the manufacturer, you know, and just some interesting information about the bottles. So we did a lot of archaeology exhibits, you know what I mean, using that information. And so I think kind of that way, it would help the public to kind of understand.
That explains it. I was thinking about the bottle one, too. You'd say you could get into the manufacturer process, but was there also a component of what these bottles maybe tell us about the people and their lifestyle and the use of medicine or not?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, that helps. Because a lot of us, you know, think of archaeology like, you know, my classic example is bags of wood chips.
Yeah.
Like, who needs that?
Yeah. exactly.
But apparently the archaeologists need that.
They at least need to save a sample, I guess. You know, they need to weigh it and figure all that out and then maybe save a sample. But, you know, a lot of times you end up with, in your collection, big bags of charcoal.
Yeah.
Which you don't need.
Right.
But, you know, as long as they've already recorded the weight and all that and maybe save a sample. Yeah.
But so when an archaeologist brings you a collection and let's say it's got all those bags of charcoal, would you say, we don't want all those, we just want the sample?
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes we'd end up having to just... you know, like I've gone through some of the old archaeology collections,
mm-hmm.
and Deb's helped me. And we would go through some where the whole box was full of samples.
Right.
And we would ourselves weigh it, you know, record that information on the catalog record and then just save a sample and then make a note that that's what we'd done so that we wouldn't have all that stuff that wasn't needed. And, you know, we'd talk to the archaeologists about it and they'd be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
But they just never would do it themselves. They just wouldn't.
Well, it's hard to get rid of things.
You might need it.
Exactly, you might need it. So what was the community of Skagway like, and what was it like living there?
That, you know, the fact that I'd lived in so many parks, little bitty tight communities, mm-hmm. you know, not in a town, but actually in the national park, I was kind of used to little community type stuff. When I was in Minnesota, I was living in Grand Marais, so that actually was a town. But Skagway, it didn't really seem that small to me because I was used to isolated parks.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing I was told, you know, when I got there is, be careful who you talk about because they're going to be related to somebody or somebody used to be married to them or, you know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's a very tight community that way. I found people were, you know, very friendly. You know, a few people weren't so happy about the park service coming in,
mm-hmm.
but you have that anywhere, you know.
Right.
It's what's never changed is the housing situation in that town. I was fortunate in that a rental came open.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to Evelyn, the admin person, and saying, should I take it? You know, because I hadn't even gotten there yet. She said, oh, yeah, you take it. There's no housing in this town, you know, and I get there and I find out, yeah, that's for sure. And that's been an issue. You know, Deb says it's even worse maybe right now for people to have housing. And I rented a house twice, two houses, and then I was able to purchase a house finally,
mm-hmm.
Which was hard because everybody wanted it too. You know, it's like anything that comes open in Skagway.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
Was there any ever discussion within the Park Service to build Park Service housing someplace?
Well, they did for seasonals, you know.
Yeah.
And, well, I guess they're still working on that.
Because you say in other parks and other places, you live in park housing.
Right.
And Skagway doesn't seem to have much official park housing. And if that's ever been discussed.
It has. But you know the reason that they've done that in the past is they feel that people that live in a town that work for a park should support that town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the Park Service shouldn't provide housing. But that's if there's housing available. You know, if there's just, I can see that, you know. You shouldn't just have, you know, Park Service housing if there's housing available in the community.
Right.
But yeah, that's been the issue, you know, that they should support the community by renting or, you know, that kind of a thing. But, you know, they've had that area that's now mostly customs housing, that started out to be permanent Park Service housing, the ones that the park had.
Right.
But it was supposed to be the lower graded employees that couldn't afford a rental or to purchase a house until Susan Boudreau came in, and she didn't want to buy a house because she still had her house in Glacier Bay. So then all of a sudden, chief of maintenance, superintendent, the chief of interpretation, all those people were living in those low cost houses. Yeah, and that was an issue.
Mm-hmm.
That was an issue. And I think they've kind of gotten away from that again now. But they're talking about, Deb was telling me they're talking about building sort of like a bunkhouse there next to the Pantheon that would be seasonal again, though. Seasonal housing.
Right.
The Cedar House, one of the seasonal houses, I think they're leaving open for the new superintendent. So they are kind of, you know, having to look at that a little bit.
Yeah. So while you were there, so they hired the resources person. Was there sort of a major shift in the top leadership positions? The chief of maintenance, chief ranger, chief admin? Was there a big kind of upheaval and people left or anything?
Not at the beginning. You know, it was like when Clay was there, and see, we had an administrative technician, Clydeen, who's now still there, but she's at the library. She was the admin tech. We didn't have an admin officer. John Warder was the chief of maintenance, and you know, they both stayed there quite a bit longer after I was there, when I got there. Betsy Duncan Clark was chief of interp for a long time, mm-hmm. till she finally went to Klondike, Seattle. People tended to stay during that time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Clay left and John retired and, you mm-hmm. know, things started, you know, Betsy transferred. But it wasn't all at once. It was kind of a slow, just a normal change.
Yeah, you don't feel it was that there was something going on that...
No, not at all. I know we had some issues when Bruce Noble was there. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any, but the chief of admin, which we had by then a chief of admin, and our chief ranger got the regional office involved. We had a little powwow.
Okay.
And I know that some people feel that after that a bunch of people left, but I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think it, again, was just normal moving.
Okay. Yeah, the Park Service people do move.
Yeah, they move a lot.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody. There's Carl.
Yeah. Well, and you were there from 91 till...
I was there 19 years.
So you left in 2010?
Yeah. Which is amazing, considering all the other parks I worked at.
Yeah. So why did you stay in Skagway for so long?
I liked it. You know, I actually, at one stage, when I was working on the Moore House, a position came open back at Hubble Trading Post as mm-hmm. curator. And I applied for it, and I got it. And I was right in the middle of the Moore House, and I went and I talked to Clay. And I said, Clay, do you feel like I've been here too long, and maybe I'm kind of losing a little spark, and you think maybe I should take this job? He broke into tears.
No.
No. And then we were both in tears.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, I'm staying. I said, I really want to see this project through. So, you know, and then after that, I liked Alaska, you know. I really enjoyed being there and everything. And, you know, I'd probably still be there if it weren't for, you know, medical and just, right. you know, all that kind of stuff. I probably still would. But, that was kind of interesting. Yeah, I just ended up liking it. And then I'd get involved in other projects and, you know, I was making friends there. And I was moving around so much before I kind of hesitated making friends, you know, really.
Yeah.
Because then you'd leave, you know, and stuff, or other people would leave, your Park Service friends would leave, and it's kind of hard that way.
Mm-hmm. But in Skagway, you were willing to set down some roots.
Yeah, and I, you know, bought a house, and I liked the house, and it was good. Deb and I were really good friends. Mm-hmm. She was one of my better friends, and yeah, I really enjoyed it. And, you know, overall, I enjoyed the staff that was there, and, you know, there's always issues here and there. And people you don't necessarily get along with, but I thought overall it was a very professional staff, and you know, overall people I thought did pretty well.
Yeah, so there wasn't the time where it was just everybody was grumpy and low morale and...
Well, I guess that it didn't affect me. Let me put it that way. Of course, I was in a different building too. Right. That helps. I liked that, but you know, I think that must have been a bad time. Just because of them calling the regional office in mm-hmm. and stuff. It must have been. Mm-hmm. But I kind of had to sit through that whole thing too. And kind of going, why am I here? Or what's going on?
You didn't feel the direct effects.
Not at all.
Well, as you say, being in a separate building can help.
Helps a lot.
And then in terms of the community of Skagway, you said there were some... skepticism towards the Park Service. Did you feel that personally?
No, I never did. You know, I would hear people occasionally talk about, well, when the Park Service first came in, especially.
Right.
People were leery about it. But then when they saw, you know, what they were doing and the buildings being restored and influx of tourists and stuff like that, which is what most of the people there are all about, not
right,
all of them.
Right.
I think overall, the Park Service was pretty well respected in that town.
By the time you were there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then did you find ways to integrate into the community and get involved in activities and things?
I helped start the first animal shelter there.
Oh, cool.
So I was pretty involved with that kind of thing. I still am.
Uh-huh.
But, so I would do, I did that. And I was on the city museum board. So I was involved with the board, with them that way.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, out and about and having coffee with people and stuff like that. But, you know, it was just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing major.
Yeah.
Not like here where I'm volunteering every which way.
Well, you were working.
Exactly.
Then, but you did get involved and make friends with people.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it was not hard. You know, it was very, very easy. I had a couple of the teachers I was close friends with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we would ski together and hike together. And I married them on the Chilkoot Trail.
Nice.
So, kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of the, as you say, the small town.
Yeah.
Can be good and it can be not good.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I was careful about not getting involved with stuff, you know, but just, you know, just being friendly and just being apart. It was
mm-hmm.
not hard at all.
Any other, did I miss any other collection, curatorial things? Particularly interesting collections you worked on?
You want me to tell you my favorite artifact?
Oh, yes. Of course.
When they were doing restoration work up on the Pantheon, they were on the rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
They came across a swallow's nest that still had the eggs in it, and the bedding was made from the pink feathers from the ladies' boas from the red onion.
How cool.
So this whole little nest was lined with this pink
wow.
boa. And I guess they scared off the parents when they were doing the work.
Oh.
But anyway, so the guys called me up over there, you know, and I said, oh, well, that's too bad, but how cool is this? And so I collected it.
Well, it's cool they called
put
you,
it in
they
the, yeah.
just destroy it.
Yeah, so that's in the collection. Isn't
cool.
that fun?
That's
it's
fun.
Just, it's just kind of a neat little, you know, story, you know, that kind of ties the
mm-hmm.
gold rush to the tourism and natural history.
Yeah. The Chilkoot Trail made me think about Dai and Chilkoot Trail, mm-hmm. if objects in the collection from those locations.
Actually, I was involved for a few years of doing a, what did we call it, collections inventory and monitoring on the Chilkoot Trail. So somebody had started that years before. They had numbered and identified objects in Dai and objects in Canyon City and,
mm-hmm.
you know, on up the trail all the way to the top. And so the idea of this was just to check on if they're still there, you know, how badly are they deteriorating, you know. Some things were ended up being collected, you know, some things like that. But that was pretty fun. You know, that got me out on the trail a couple different years.
Yeah. So was there a change in those items?
Yeah, you know, there would be. And, you know, like the one thing that I really hated to see while I was there is at Canyon City, there was a saw that was stuck in a tree? And it had been there since the gold rush. And one year the handle had fallen off. You know, so
yeah.
That's kind of, you know, that's kind of too bad. You know, a lot of things like the stoves, we would conserve them, we would just clean them, we'd knock the moss off of them, you know, just the plants so
mm-hmm.
that they're not eating away at the metal. So we would do that kind of work on the trail for the metal objects.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but after a while, they're gonna go. But that, again, is part of the Chilkoot Trail, you know, just seeing artifacts and stuff along the way.
Yeah.
So there again, that's a hard call. None of that stuff is cataloged. You can't, because you can't protect it.
But it's
inventoried.
Inventoried and numbered.
Yeah, but it's a separate system.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just an inventory system.
Okay. And so were there items that when you were out there, they'd been inventoried in the past, and they were gone.
Mm-hmm. Not too often, but sometimes maybe we just didn't see it. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes things got covered, like bottles, little things, you know, got covered with dirt.
Right.
And maybe we just didn't find them. And there were times in the past, like we were doing this like every 3 years, somebody would go out and mm-hmm. inventory, if we could, if right. we had the money. Didn't happen, but supposedly. Maybe 1 year something would be missing, but then the next time you're out there it was, you'd find it again.
Did people pick it up and move it?
Maybe, or you just missed it the 1 year. Just somehow missed it.
So was it mapped? Were the locations
mapped?
Yeah,
but mapped? You know, it was still kind of hard to... This is before GPS marking, you know.
And were there some items that you collected for their own protection?
There was that, yeah, occasionally. There were occasionally some pretty cool things that were unique. A wooden bucket, for example. Mm-hmm. Some of the breakdown boats that were stashed partway up the trail, mm-hmm. we actually brought in two or three of those. One of them's at another museum. Can't think where it is. Because otherwise, I mean, those were pretty unique.
Yeah.
You know, oh, one of them we actually sent off to a conservator, two kits, and they actually reassembled it.
Oh, cool.
Put it back together, and I can't remember where that is now either. Hmm. But so, you know, we did that kind of thing
because
just
those
to conserve
just...
them.
Falling apart.
Oh, yeah, because it was just like canvas and wood.
Yeah. I'm surprised they were still there in as good shape as they were.
They were covered with snow most of the time.
Well, that's an interesting thing, is that with changing climate conditions, less snow or things coming out that weren't there before.
Yeah.
Oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah, those boats used to be just covered. Maybe hardly exposed at all, you know, is what I understand. Hmm. And now there they are.
So it adds to the curatorial duties on the trail.
Yeah. But there again, you figure if you've got samples, good samples of them, mm-hmm. you know, then you've done what you can. You know, right. you don't need all of them, but as long as you have one or two of them conserved.
Mm-hmm. And what about the White Pass unit? Were there things that got brought in from there? Did you have anything to do with that?
They had done a little bit of archaeology years ago mm-hmm. out there, and I think they've done some since. But we had very little, because there again, you know what? I don't think they'd actually done archaeology there. They had just walked around it and maybe collected a thing or two. I remember a blue bottle that had come mm-hmm. from there that shouldn't have really come in. You know what I mean? Because they hadn't really done archaeology to mark provenience yet. So it was more a matter of wandering around and just seeing cool stuff.
Yeah,
and I had one opportunity. I did have an opportunity to go down there.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, just one.
Uh-huh. Tell me about that.
We got to go across the river on a zip line. That was fun.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was neat.
So were you going to White Pass City?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we took the train, and then they dropped us off, and then we went down, 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 down.
Yeah.
And then somebody had set up a pulley ropey thing across the Skagway River.
Wow.
And the thing that we were noticing, though, is that bears, and moose, broken artifacts. See, that's mm-hmm. the issue. Not from humans, because, you know, hardly anybody knew how to get down there or anything. But things were getting broken a little bit from the wildlife.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, there was a lot of stuff laying around down there.
So do you remember what year you went?
Oh, maybe 92 or 93. It was right at the beginning, yeah.
What was the purpose of going, and who did you go with?
It was a big group. Clay went. Chief of Maintenance went. You know what? They might have been starting to think about, you know, they keep thinking about doing archaeology or survey. Maybe it was just a survey trip. Just to see how things were looking. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that was the reason. Nobody had been down there for a long time, and it was just a way to see how it looked.
Yeah.
But I remember Clay went, and our chief ranger went, and there was probably about eight of us.
Was Tim the Stidell the chief ranger yet?
No, you know who was there was
Reed?
Jeff. Oh, you know who was there was Jeff Mao.
Oh, Jeff Mao, okay.
Who wasn't chief ranger, but he was the ranger.
Yeah.
That was before we really had that. We didn't have a chief ranger either yet.
Really?
Really.
Huh.
Jeff was kind of it, but he was more like a district ranger, kind of.
Hmm, okay.
Yeah, because Bruce Reed was right. The first chief ranger to be hired, I'm pretty sure.
Well, no, Jay Cable was before.
You're right.
He was before.
You are right, and that's when I got hired.
And so I think he was chief ranger.
You are right.
And then
But then he went back to the region.
Yeah, I don't know what. And then
you're right.
I just know names. There was also Bruce Reed. I don't know.
He came next.
There was a Reed McCluskey.
Yep, he was there too.
But I don't know if he was chief. I don't know who was in what role. Yes, he was.
Yeah, you are right. Jay Cable was there. He had gone back to the regional office when I moved there. And actually, Clay was on a detail. He didn't hire me. Hmm. Somebody that was acting from the regional office is actually who hired me. Can't think who that was either. And then Bruce Reed came in. He was the next one hired.
As chief ranger.
Chief ranger. And then when he left, then Reed McCluskey was hired as chief ranger. Mm-hmm. But then he ended up as chief of administration, and Tim Stidell ended up as chief ranger.
Right. I knew there was some
reorganizational. Yeah, but you are right. There was already a chief ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Jeff Mao was there. I think it was in transitions still at that stage. So Jeff Mao was kind of in charge, and he's the one that had the rope rigged up and everything.
Cool.
Yeah.
And who was chief of maintenance then?
John Warder.
Oh, John Warder, okay.
Yeah, John was the chief of maintenance, and he was there for quite a few years still after that.
It must have been quite a bushwhack down there.
It was. It was. Yeah, it was fun.
hard to come back up.
Yeah, it was not easy. Yeah, it was fun.
Okay, so you said favorite artifact. What is there something that was the hardest, worst material or collection to work on?
I really didn't like the rusty archaeology stuff. I just didn't. I like glass, working with glass and mm-hmm. stuff like that, but I liked the historic collections, I liked archives, I liked the natural history. I love ethnographic collections. That's my favorite. We didn't have much of that.
Well, that was my question, is you mentioned ethnographic before. How much was there?
Not much. The fact that Minnie Moore was Tlingit. Mm-hmm. There were a few Tlingit-related items in the mm-hmm. collection. It's some carved ivory. It's actually in the Moore House exhibit.
So that even though it was potentially from the Moore family, it's considered ethnographic because...
I don't think that one was.
That would be historic.
I think that one was considered. In that collection, I think that was historic.
Yeah.
We had very little. We had acquired a little bit of Tlingit stuff here and there. Baskets. Mm-hmm. We had some baskets and that kind of thing, but very little, very little. I bet you there's only no more than a dozen ethnographic items in the collection.
Yeah. Because the Park Service, I guess it somewhat tells the Native story, but it's not as much a part of their storytelling.
Yeah. Just, the Minnie Moore story was the big part, and she was, pure... all Tlingit.
And then the Packers.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, does the City Museum have a more ethnographic collection?
Yes, they do. Okay. Judy's got some pretty cool stuff.
Okay.
She's got a duck blanket that I love, made out of duck feathers.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, she's got quite a bit more stuff, because they do tell more of that story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Besides the Rapuzzi collection... What kind of a relationship was there between the City Museum and the Park Service collections?
Not much. Not much. The interaction we had was, there for a while I was on the City Museum board, and Carl was also at a mm-hmm. time. And Carl and Judy have always been good friends. Mm-hmm. So they've always just worked together for, photos and things like that. But as far as actual, collections, not until the Rapuzzi collection did Judy and I really interact that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it worked out all right.
Yeah.
What about with the Seattle unit of Klondike? Did you have any interaction with them?
a little bit, and that was in them, let's see, did they borrow some artifacts? Yes, they had some artifacts on loan from us as part of their permanent exhibits. And then, what else? There was one other, not much. There was some other conservation issue that came up that I worked with them on. But they had one of their interpreters was, his collateral duty was collections.
Yeah.
So.
Well, but that doesn't mean they know.
No, they don't have much.
Yeah. So they don't have a very big collection?
No, it's very small.
So you don't feel they needed it? They, a regular curator?
Because they're, you know, they're a building, basically, yeah. is what their site is. It's a building.
Right.
And just exhibits and visitor center.
So you were never called down to go down there to help with them with anything?
I was down there once, and I'm trying to remember why. I was there with their collections, yeah. and I don't recall why.
Oh, but so you were, you did help them with something.
Yeah. Yeah, it must have been on the side when I was down there for some other purpose. But I don't remember exactly. It had to do with some conservation issue, but I don't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah. But so that'd say that in a place like that, having curation as collateral duty works.
Yeah.
But it would never work in Skagway.
No. No, it's just too much. Too much to deal with.
Yeah. So did you get through the backlog in your 19 years?
You know, there were still archives backlogs just because people, well, I left them backlog archives.
Well, every employee that leaves then creates a new collection, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there were still those odd archaeology collections that hadn't been, but not much, mm-hmm. not much. I think there was like 1 or 2 years of some projects that hadn't been processed properly when I left. But other than that, we were up to date on our natural history collections. All that was cataloged and entered. We had the Rapuzzi collection. Everything else, you know, everything else. But the growing ones are always the archives and the archaeology as they're doing more projects. So those are always going to continue job security.
Yeah, there you go. You have good staff turnover, so we have job security.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you retire when you left?
Yes.
Or you didn't come to do some other job?
No,
then?
I had 30 years in.
That's...
I was 56.
Yeah.
And I just decided, you know, I could have earned more if I'd waited, but I just decided that was good enough. I was ready. And, you know, I don't regret retiring. I miss the national parks. I don't miss the National Park Service anymore. I think things have gone a bit downhill.
And what do you mean?
Administration from the top. I've talked to more and more people, friends of mine in the past that are retired or are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing, you know, the same thing, you know, people that have just retired. A friend of mine, Tim Stone, who retired as a superintendent back east, says, you know, he says, Debbie, we were there at the right time. You know, he said, it's just things are crazy now. It's just not the support that we used to have. It's just different. And I don't know, maybe the baby boomer age was kind of, I don't know. It was just kind of the right time. You know, when I first started working for the Park Service, women were just then put in uniforms.
Oh.
And we had to wear men's
because
there was not a woman's uniform at the time. And that was at Mesa Verde National Park, where part of giving tours is crawling through tunnels and climbing up ladders. And the first women's uniforms were skirts.
So you had to do that in your skirt.
I think there they let people. I don't know.
You don't remember.
Well, they let me. At that stage, they were letting us in men's uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
But that was right at the beginning.
But so, yeah, when you started, you know, and you were doing natural history kind of interpretation stuff, were there many women?
No. 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 I remember going to, when I was going to college even, the College of Forestry in Fort Collins, we had a summer camp between certain years, sophomore, mm-hmm. junior or something. And, you know, it was all phases of natural resource stuff. And I think that whole group, there were only two or three women in that.
Wow.
Even. And yeah, very few women.
So at the time, it was a field that women weren't as involved in. Why did you decide to go into that field and study that?
I remembered as a kid, we used to visit national parks. And some of my better memories are that. And attending evening programs, like campfire programs, mm-hmm. and listening to these male rangers.
Right.
But, you know, talk. And just this whole thing, you know, just that whole natural thing. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I started out going to a different school, and Adams State College, and was going to study art. And then all of a sudden, after my freshman year, I said, that's not what I want to do. And I don't know, I just started thinking about it and started looking it up and found out that Colorado State University had a really good school and applied and went. And yeah, it was just great. It was great. And that was, you know, really at the beginning. And they even had a annual naturalist award given at that university, the Merlin Potts Outstanding Naturalist Award, which I was the recipient of mm-hmm. one year. So, you know, that was just fun. And very supportive professors, you know, some of them I stayed in touch with for years mm-hmm. afterwards and stuff. So,
do you feel as a woman getting into the Park Service in those years, was it more difficult to be hired?
When I went to Mesa Verde, we had a assistant superintendent who was actually a very nice looking man. I learned that he would go through the applications. That was all paper applications right. at that stage. He would go through the women's applications, and at that stage you had to put down your height and your weight.
Did the men have to also?
Yes.
Okay.
He would pull out any that he felt were fat.
Wow.
But he only did that with the women. Hmm. So isn't that weird?
No, well, by today's standards, weird. By 1970s,
yeah.
maybe not.
Yeah. I was told that later, that that's what he would do.
But you got the job.
I got the job.
So you were more working in a more male-dominated environment. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
I was, you know, I think that the guys were kind of glad to see women coming into mm-hmm. it. I think they really were. Because I was always treated with respect and, you know, not babied or anything. I was always treated with respect. So...
Do you have any idea whether you were paid the same as the men?
Yeah, we were. Because it was all the GS wages. Okay. So, yeah, we were paid the same.
But obviously they could have made the position they hired the woman for a GS-4, yes, and the man could've. Was in a GS-5.
Yes, they could have. They didn't.
But they didn't.
Yeah, we were all the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's something.
GS-4s.
Right. But by the time you were in Skagway, by the 80s, 90s, that... male-female kind of balanced out.
Sure had. Oh, yeah. Long before that, really. Yeah. It seems like it just, that was, in the 70s was when it just started, you know, women were just joining right and left.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of, you know, right there.
Yeah.
So that was kind of fun.
We're talking about the sort of top-down management that may be happening more now in the Park Service. Is it sort of more coming from D.C. instead of a park itself? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I'm thinking it's kind of just trickling down that way. Mm-hmm. And I think morale is lower. Mm-hmm. That's just what I'm hearing, you know, and just the feelings I'm getting. I kind of stay out of politics. Yeah.
That was my lead-in to... So when you were in Skagway, at Klondike, do you feel like the local... team were sort of in charge of their own destiny, or was there a lot coming down from regional?
I think that when I got there, the park was going from where there was more regional impact, you know, because curator and mm-hmm. stuff, to where, as it went on, where we got more positions, they were kind of leaving us alone a lot more.
Okay.
But when I first got there, there seemed to be still a lot coming down from the regional office.
Mm-hmm.
And then, other than kind of what jobs they're supposed to do, like the restoration specialists,
right?
You know,
the historic architects,
Steve Peterson
stuff, yeah.
and Grant Crosby people, and that's what they do.
Right.
So, but they always were very good at including park mm-hmm. staff. They weren't, you know, like on their high horses or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And you worked under two superintendents, under
three.
So, Clay.
And then Bruce Noble. And then Jim Corliss.
Oh, okay.
He was there when I retired.
Okay. Just in the general sense, management styles, how they differed, what worked, what didn't work, and you don't have to say who did what. We're talking on the general terms, like, oh, you know, it was this kind of style worked or this kind of style didn't, you know what I mean? Because I can tell you don't want to talk names. So I'm trying to...
I'm throwing them out every once in a while.
But in this case, I'm trying to get the general sense of, you know, working under different superintendents and how that worked and what worked and what didn't work.
Well, I don't even mind throwing out names
okay.
on this one,
great.
Really. Because,
okay.
I mean, obviously, I think you can tell Clay was my fave.
Yeah.
Clay was very down to earth. He was very sensitive to his staff. He involved everybody. When it was time to hire Bruce Reed... He called Betsy and Carl and I in to help him select. We got to go through the applications and help mm-hmm. him decide who to get, you know. And that's not a normal
right.
superintendent thing.
Right.
You know, so he was probably the biggest team player of the three
mm-hmm.
there that I worked under. Bruce, he's very quiet. He's a very quiet person. You know, very to himself. So I always saw him, you know, not a great team player just because he was not a great communicator.
Mm-hmm.
I liked him. I had no problem with him. But he probably was the most difficult of the three. Jim Corliss, that was his first superintendency. I actually went to Ranger Skills with him. So we knew each other already, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he did fine, too, but he was, you know, they used Skagway as a first superintendent
right.
park a lot. I think Bruce, well, I think all three of them were. But Jim, you know, he was there for a few years. He did fine.
Mm-hmm.
Clay was the team player.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's just...
Right. So what you're saying is Bruce, who was more of a quiet person, would you say he kind of kept to himself more and didn't... involve the
yes.
staff in things.
Yeah. And like I said, I still don't quite know what the issue was with him.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an
there
issue.
Was big that
enough
why, he,
to...
why he left?
No, you know, he stayed there. Well, I don't know. He stayed there longer. He was there another couple years, I believe,
mm-hmm.
before he transferred. I think he... Well, his wife was also Park Service. And I think that was really a hard thing. I think she was working out of like the regional office when
oh.
he was in Skagway.
So
Pat,
she wasn't,
Pat Noble.
She wasn't in Skagway with him.
Yes, she was most of the time, but I think she was like working from home sort
well,
of.
Yeah,
or
because she couldn't have worked for Klondike if he
no.
was superintendent.
No.
And yeah.
I think they just didn't really like Skagway.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, I think they just didn't like Skagway.
Right.
And I think Jim Corliss too, that was, he just was kind of ready to get out of Skagway.
Well, and as you say, Skagway was often for people, this is the first job, I learned the ropes, and then I moved someplace else. And so that's what sounds like Corliss was.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Did, and did he similarly kind of keep to himself?
And Susan Boudreau. I worked for four.
Oh, I don't know Susan Boudreau's.
She wasn't there very long.
She was... After Jim or between Bruce and Jim?
Yes, between Bruce and Jim.
So she was maybe a temporary...
Yeah, she was full hire.
Oh, she was?
Yep. She came from Glacier Bay. She was the natural resource specialist at Glacier Bay.
Hmm.
She went back to Glacier Bay as superintendent.
Okay.
And now she's retired.
Yeah, I don't know her name.
She was an interesting one. Maybe she... She was right there with Bruce as far as not easy to work for.
what way?
She liked to be in charge.
Okay.
Yeah. Different from Bruce, but she liked to be in charge. She maybe micromanaged a little more than she should have.
I was wondering if there was a difference between a female superintendent versus a male superintendent.
Mm. I'm trying to think if I've worked for any other women superintendents. I've worked for all men other than Susan. But maybe they feel like they have something to prove or something. I don't know.
But so Jim, since he was only there a few years, right?
Yeah.
Did he interact and engage with staff in the community?
It seems to me like I can't remember what he was doing. What did he do in the community? He was involved. I think people overall liked him in town. Yeah.
And what about Bruce?
Don't know. I don't know. People liked Clay, you know, for the most part. I think they really liked Clay.
And Clay makes me think of the Morehouse property debate and the road. Was that during your time there? Did you have any role in that, or you were?
No. Well, you know, I could voice my opinion on it, but yeah, that was pretty interesting. Yeah, that whole corner thing with the Morehouse property. And I know then we planted some trees to make it look more authentic and some stuff like that. But yeah, I wasn't real involved with that project or that issue.
And do you feel like it was resolved well?
I do. I think that turned out to be fine.
Okay.
Yeah. I know they were talking about what a safety hazard that corner was and all that kind of stuff, but...
Yeah. That's the city versus park politics, I guess.
That's part of it, yeah.
Did you have any role with the Historic District Commission?
No. Carl did.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the...
He was the guy.
He was the always on board person for that.
Yeah. Okay. Any other thing you want to say about working in Skagway? Or something, and things you miss about it?
I don't miss the busy, busy cruise ship days.
Did that affect you?
Not really. Well, just trying to get home get to the post office or, you know, that kind of thing. But no, it was kind of fun, really.
But it didn't affect you being able to do your work?
No. No, not at all. Not at all. No. I mean, I miss Skagway. You know, I'm glad I'm not there in the winters because that was getting really, really old. But, you know, it's such a gorgeous spot. It's just such a gorgeous spot. But no, overall, I'm glad I'm where I'm at and all that. I think it's been good. I'm glad I spent the time there. I'm glad I had that opportunity because it was a lot of good experience. And
I was going to say, are there things you learned?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you make mistakes and you learn. So, but, you know, there were both the Morehouse. I mean, that, like I said, was a brand new thing for me, that whole process.
Right.
You learn how historic furnishing reports are done. Or you learn all that kind of stuff. You learn research. You know, all that kind of thing. But the Rapuzzi collection was just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
That was mind-boggling. It was, I feel so fortunate, other than the unhappy incident that happened, you know, to have been considered a part of that and to have been there during that time.
Did any of you guys ever write professional papers about this is what we did in the process?
We should have.
Into the museum world?
We should have.
Yeah. But I guess maybe that's not in the purview of Park Service.
Oh, no, we're supposed to. That's one of those things, kind of like the archaeologists that don't do their processing. You know, working with the artifacts and sorting is a lot more fun than writing the report.
Well,
writing
or stuff. Also there's maybe a time pressure that we've got to get this collection organized. We don't have time to go write about it.
We had a time frame.
Yeah.
And that we were having to stick to.
For the Rapuzzi collection, yeah.
Yeah, we did. We had 3 years.
Oh, why? What was the reason for a time frame?
That was all in the agreement with Phyllis Brown. Yeah, it was all in that purchase agreement. We had this length of time. I'm not sure why.
But that was just for the inventorying and separating?
Yeah.
That wasn't for the cataloging?
No.
Because I think, isn't Deb still cataloging?
I'm sure she probably is.
Is Phyllis Brown still around?
You know, she... I know that about the time I moved there, she came back to Skagway and was actually living there.
Yeah. Well, Carl would know, I know. So
and so would Deb.
He would have told, they would have told me, and I can't remember.
I bet she's not there anymore.
Yeah.
She's pretty old.
Did you have a relationship with her?
Yeah.
What was she like? I don't know anything about her.
Oh, she was a very stern, straightforward person. She was very... We got along fine, but you had to learn to work with her. She was very assertive and had to be her way. And if she didn't like what you were doing, she'd tell you. Yeah, she's very interesting.
Yeah, but because obviously not everybody probably could get along with her.
Right. Yeah. Thank goodness Judy did too. I think we both just sort of learned, you know, how to talk to Phyllis. You just kind of had to, you know, baby her a little and just be real polite and...
And let her...
Let her
feel like she got her way.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, she's getting up there, so...
Was she involved in any of the... You know, once the collection was acquired and you guys were going through it, was she involved at all?
No. She had spent her time with Ron Klein, I think. And kind of passed her knowledge, what she had, which wasn't a whole lot, really. She just all of a sudden had acquired this collection.
Right.
You know, but she kind of turned it over to Ron as far as being responsible and answering our questions and all that kind of stuff.
So, because I wondered how much you and Judy interacted with her and for what reasons would you interact with her?
There for a while, she was living in the Alaskom house.
Okay.
And we were working in that building. So it would just be kind of seeing her leave and come, and she'd occasionally come over and say hi and see what we were doing. And, you know, just that kind of interaction. Nothing too much. Oh, and the Rapuzzi house, too, because she was living in the Rapuzzi house for a while. And so, you know, she would still, when we'd be over there, at times she'd pop over. It was just across the street. And she'd pop over and just see what we were doing and stuff.
Did you consult with her on what's this or how did this get...
Occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah, occasionally we would. And a lot of times she'd say, you have to ask Ron.
Okay.
So we'll do. Oh, I can't really, I'm trying to think. I'm glad a couple things like White Pass came up, you know, that was good. I hadn't really thought about that, but no, I can't really think of anything else significant.
Okay.
Or
not significant. Well, we will stop for now then, and if we think of something else, we can turn it back on. All right. Thanks, Deb.
Mm-hmm.